Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, everyone. It's Takuya here.
And I'm Gabby.
And welcome back to the podcast, my hoes. Welcome back. And I got to say here, guys, it has been a ton of fun going through all these varying stories. Thank you to everyone who's been sending in a bunch of different suggestions about things it is that we should do. If you have any ideas of podcast episodes that you want to hear, make sure to go to our website and definitely contact us and send us in ideas, as I love hearing all of them. Also, if you all want to have some fun with us, if you want to go and actually explore places in Europe and around the world with us, we are going to be leading a trip to both Peru, which is going to be in July, and also Germany. We still have some spots available. In fact, there's still a couple early bird spots that are left for the German trip. So if you go and click the link down in the description, make sure that you try and get in on that as soon as you can, because that is $200 off that you can get on the trip, and you only have to pay 25% upfront. Past that, you can have a payment plan option, and it makes things significantly easier for all of you. Now, that all being said, the previous episode that we did is that we went into a little bit of Holy Roman and Papal history, which I figured that since we did that, we have covered a lot of stuff that is European history. And that's not like, it's not like something that was done intentionally, though. Gabby, you have definitely said that we have done a lot of European history recently.
I feel like it was a lot of history that everybody knows, you know?
At least to a degree. But then again, I always end up running into the trap of thinking, oh yeah, no, everyone knows this. And then we keep on getting messages of like, why didn't you explain this more? I didn't know anything about this. So it just ends up falling into that same kind of trap. And it just turns out that this is what people had been requesting at the time. But I did see something that would be incredibly fun. And I said at the end of the previous episode that we were going to be going into the story of Ibn Battuta, which I'm probably going to mispronounce a lot of names in here, but I'm going to try my absolute best to work with this, because there is going to be a lot of varying Arabic. And when I say Arabic, I just mean Muslim names, and it's going to primarily be from the lens of Arabic writers, though there are many, many, many more. How familiar are you with Ibn Battuta, Gabby?
Not at all.
Then that is pretty much everyone. That in the Western world, when we go and study a lot of different explorers in history, usually you're thinking Europeans, right? Like when you think of the age of exploration, you're thinking of Europeans in the 15th and 16th century. Like Christopher Columbus and others.
Sail the ocean blue.
Literally that. Out to discover the new world. Or in the case of earlier ones, you think of like Marco Polo. And Marco Polo was not just a pool game for anyone who is curious. No, we're talking about the Venetian explorer that was known for the book, The Travels of Marco Polo, which describes his voyage and experiences in Asia. Polo would travel extensively with his family, journeying from Europe to Asia over the course of 1271 to 1295, and he would actually be in China for 17 of those years. Around 1292, he left China and went back along the way. Like he went back to Europe. When he did so, he even had adventures where he went and escorted a Mongolian princess who was supposed to be sent to Persia. It is fascinating, and I know he deserves his own story, but we're going to get right back into that whole European thing again, so we're going to talk about that at a later time. Either way, the reason why I bring that up is that there is an individual in history who arguably traveled the most that we have on record of anyone in the, I'm not going to say ancient world, that's not the right terminology here. This is a person who traveled, God, I don't even know, what was the distance in here? Something like 75,000 miles?
Mr. Worldwide.
Literally, he was Mr. Worldwide before he knew this.
Before Pitbull was Mr. Worldwide.
Before Pitbull was ever a thing. This is Ibn Battuta, the greatest medieval Muslim traveler in history and the author of one of the most famous travel books, the Rilla, which is just like the travels. Now, the actual book title that we're talking about here is A Gift to Those Who Contemplate the Wonders of Cities and the Marvels of Traveling, which is a way longer title in the first place. But also, weirdly enough, Battuta, unlike Polo, did not actually keep any journal whatsoever of his travels. Like, this guy traveled for 25, 30 years, and he never kept a journal from which to translate his thoughts later into an actual, like, book. He literally went back home and then composed his Rilla from memory. And this was then written down and embellished upon by another Islamic scholar, Juzay al-Kalbi. And this would occur between the year 1352 to 1355. So everything that we're going to hear here at this point, just note, there some things need to be taken with a grain of salt, as this is literally from the memory of a person who is doing so 30 years later. And on top of that, it is being embellished upon by another person. Things could be wrong due to mistranslation. It could also be wrong due to not remembering something. There's just going to be a lot of stuff that is going to be happening. But either way, still, the great work that we're talking about is something that covers hugely extensive travels, something over the course of like 75,000 miles, or for those who use the metric system, 120,000 kilometers. We're talking about a trip that was going to go through almost every single Muslim country, though I guess country is the wrong word to use here in this regard, but Muslim land, going all the way into China and even Sumatra, which is now part of modern day Indonesia. He was going to see things that very few people ever in history got to see. Even fewer got to see multiple of these things. And he is one of the very, very, very few sources that we have of some of these places to actually be able to understand what they were like.
Question, was he super rich?
No, actually, interestingly enough. He did come from a wealthy-ish or at least influential family, but simultaneously he had to earn his living as he was traveling. And I'm going to explain that here in a second. So Ibn Battuta was born in the non-European quarter of Tangier, Morocco on the 25th of February, 1304. And his full name, get ready for this, all right, as it is given in the Rilla, was Shams al-Din Abu Abdallah Muhammad ibn Abdallah ibn Muhammad ibn Ibrahim ibn Muhammad ibn Yusuf al-Awati al-Tanj ibn Battuta.
I love it.
Yeah, dear Lord, that is a name. I love it.
Imagine filling in, you know when you take the SAT or the ACT and you have to do the bubbles for your name?
Oh my
and
Lord.
And I had a super long name, so I would be like sweating. Imagine doing that with that name.
Yeah, exactly. Now, for anyone who is not aware of this, in Arabic, Ibn in his name means son of in Arabic. So even within his lineage, there were quite a lot of Muhammads in his lineage, which, to be fair, that is quite literally something that is the most common name in the world. So you're going to see a lot of that. So all we know of his family specifically comes from the Rilla, which records references to his education and also his lineage. That's it. That's all that we have from this. What we know of him is that he seems to have gone by the name Shams al-Din, but we're just going to call him Battuta, since that's what most people know him as, is Ibn Battuta. He came from a very educated background, a family of qadis, which is like Islamic judges, and he was extremely dedicated and devoted to Islam, which he studied extensively over the course of his entire life. And before we explain that and get into the story, you were asking if he came from a wealthy family.
Were judges wealthy? I mean, if they took bribes, I'm sure they could be.
Okay, fair. Yes. But this is a crucial detail that I think needs to be explained because many people listening won't understand the details of varying different religions. Like, most people who are listening to this probably know more about Christianity than they do from Islam. And so what I'm going to be explaining here directly comes from the Encyclopedia Britannica for anyone wondering. But what a qadi is a Muslim judge who renders decisions according to Sharia law, like Islamic law. The qadi's jurisdiction theoretically includes civil as well as criminal matters, but in most cases, it is primarily a civil thing, especially in relation to advice and marriage and these kinds of things. In modern states, like if you look at it nowadays, these are things that still exist, But the caddies that exist now generally only hear cases that are related to your personal issues and religious customs, like those involving inheritance, marriage, and divorce, stuff like that. But originally, the caddies' work was restricted to non-administrative tasks, like arbitrating disputes, rendering judgments in matters that were brought before him, and eventually, they would go on to assume a lot of important managerial roles within communities, things like literally being the guardians of the property for anyone who's orphaned. Like, if you had a bunch of soldiers who went out and then they got killed, you know, and there's orphans that are left behind, the property would be overseen by the judges to make sure that they don't get taken advantage of and abused. Also, this applies to people who had cognitive disabilities or just really in general others that were not capable of actually overseeing their own affairs and interests. He even had control of marriages for women who did not have any parents. Like, let's say that they didn't have a father or an uncle or an older brother or someone that was supposed to be managing their marriage, right? In that scenario.
What does it mean managing them? Like managing them getting married or managing them being married?
Both.
Explain.
Well, specifically in this case, it's like if you had a person who, let's say that they had no male relatives, then that means that in their marriage, it would be the qadi that would be the person that would be there to kind of protect them, to oversee them. And in the case of a person who is getting married, the way that that would be organized or controlled, there's a variety of different ways this could happen. And I'm not going to speak for literally all societies, but generally a qadi would be able to oversee and influence how, like if a marriage was even going to go forth, because it would be almost like being a guardian for an orphan. That sort of thing.
Makes sense.
Even though there are cases of women having more or certain rights within Islamic societies, there are many other cases where they do not and are specifically they have a guardian that actually has to control things. It really varies depending upon the time, place, and area and the specific culture that is involved. But that's what we're referring to here. Theoretically, though, the qadi's decision was final in all matters, at least theoretically, which is something that within these communities gave them very powerful roles in Muslim societies. And because the qadi performed an essential function in early Muslim society, the requirement to actually be one of those was something that was very carefully controlled and stipulated. It had to be an adult Muslim male of good character, so no one who was corrupt, though obviously things could happen. They had to possess sound knowledge of Sharia law and was a free man. You could not have a slave that would grow to become a qadi. That couldn't happen. In the 7th and 8th centuries, the qadi were expected to be capable of delivering or deriving the specific rule of law from their sources in the Quran. They had to know the hadith, the traditions of the prophet. They had to know the imja, the consensus of the community. They had to know all these varying details. And although this was the ideal of what was supposed to happen, in practice, Muslim states began to appoint qadis on the condition that they issue judgments according to a very specific school of Islamic law. Because with time, Islam would splinter into varying different thoughts of law for how it was supposed to work. And this was done specifically to guarantee rulership control of the region and also to guarantee that it was actually predictable and they knew what was going to happen. Anyway, the reason why I'm explaining all this, the reason why I'm having to establish what a qadi is that this is what Batuta was. He was a qadi. He was very well educated. And oh my God, did he know this well, and he understood Islam. According to the records, he memorized the Quran and, as he reports, would sometimes go and recite it in its entirety twice a day, like during his travels.
How long is the Quran?
It's pretty extensive. I don't know the actual page count of what it would be, but you're talking about reciting something that is essentially the Bible.
Yeah, but you can't recite the Bible twice in one day.
No, and it's not as long as the Bible. It's not. But still, that is reciting an entire book twice per day. And that's just what he would do because he knew it by heart orally. In June of 1325, this is when he decided, as a young man, I think he was 21 years old at this point, he decides that it is time that he goes on his first pilgrimage to Mecca. And there he would write, quote, "I set out alone, having neither fellow traveler in whose companionship I might find cheer, nor caravan whose part I might join, but swayed by an overmastering impulse within me and desire long cherished in my bosom to visit these illustrious sanctuaries. So I braced my resolution to quit my dear ones, female and male, and forsook my home as birds forsake their nests. My parents being yet in the bonds of life, it weighed sorely upon me to part from them, and both they and I were afflicted with sorrow at this separation.
Hey everyone, Sakuya here, and before we get back to the show, I would just like to thank today's sponsor, eBay Motors. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential, and then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you can make sure that your ride stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, exhaust kits, turbochargers, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
This was going to be the Hajj, which, for people not familiar with Islam, that is the sacred pilgrimage in which you actually go to the holy sites in Mecca. This is where you go to the Kaaba. This is where this is easily the holiest site in all of Islam. Now, initially, he set himself only up to specifically accomplish the pilgrimage. He didn't really have any kind of thoughts about going further than Mecca. There was no plan to become Mr. Worldwide, as you said, Gabby. That wasn't supposed to happen. And from there, he would travel across North Africa to Tunis, where upon entering the city, he would record how he felt incredibly lonely and homesick. As he would say, townsfolk would come forward on all sides and greet and question one another, but not a soul said a word in greeting to me, since there was none of them that I knew. I felt so sad at heart on account of my loneliness that I could not restrain the tears that started to my eyes and wept bitterly. And I mean, come on. Look, back in the day, travel was not easy. You and I travel a lot. Like, we do this a lot. And even then, we still can kind of get homesick and tired of it from being away for a time.
I think it only happens when you're in like a town or a city where it's just not, you're not vibing with it.
Yeah,
and then you're
it's
like,
true.
Ooh, time to go.
And you got to think about this, though. Back in the day, it would have been way harder for people. I mean, it's much harder, longer, and way more scary of a journey. Literally anyone in this scenario would feel a little bit homesick, you know? But when he did this, he was being consoled by a fellow pilgrim who introduced him to other educated men. And with this help, he was able to find lodging at the College of Booksellers. From there, he would leave Tunis for Alexandria, Egypt, in the company of a caravan for protection on the road, which is a strategy that he would oftentimes employ throughout his travels. Because back in the day, you didn't really want to be traveling alone. It was very risky from, you know, bandits, disease, literally anything could happen. And in Alexandria, he would meet a very devout mystic by the name of Burhan al-Din, who, according to a story, would prophesize that he would visit Sindh, which is in Pakistan. He would visit India and China, and there he would enjoy the hospitality of al-Din's three brothers who lived in those regions. So kind of a bit of prediction or foreshadowing to come. Do we know that that actually happened? No, but that is the story that he would say. Later on, while he was in Alexandria, while staying with the Sheikh al-Murshidi, Ibn Battuta would have a dream, apparently, in which he was carried by a great bird to Mecca, but then beyond to lands that he never thought to see. The Sheikh would go and interpret his dream for him as being a sign that he would reach Mecca, but his travels were going to take him way further than that. And these experiences that he would have in Alexandria would cause him to rethink his original plan. Was he really going to just return home after the pilgrimage? No, instead he was thinking what would happen if he would travel. Not for the sake of going to any particular place, but just literally travel for the sake of traveling. The journey over the destination was going to be the thing that was going to be more important. You know, it's kind of like one of those things that we do. You know how like when we're planning to actually go to a place, we're like, hey, do we want to make a plan of every single site that we're going to be going to? No. We're just going to freaking go.
You just go for it.
We just literally go for it and see what it is that we find. And we ultimately end up having a lot more fun, I think, because then we don't have to stress about going to each and every single thing and hitting every single target, you know? Well, either way, from Alexandria, he would go to Cairo. And from there, he would move through Palestine and Syria towards Mecca. And when he would travel through Palestine, he would write, quote, I visited Bethlehem, the birthplace of Jesus. The site is covered by a large building, and the Christians regard it with intense veneration and hospitably entertain all who alight at it. And upon reaching Jerusalem, he would marvel at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, writing that the sacred mosque is the most beautiful building, and it is said to be the largest mosque in the world. In Damascus, he would say that it was the city which surpasses all other cities in beauty, as he would write that he would record the generosity of the government and the upper classes in providing endowments to those that were less fortunate and for developing varying parts of the city. This was going to be something that he would marvel at, just the differences in all the varying peoples around the world. And he, in particular, loved the beautiful old cities of Islam. He had the most to say when describing things like this. And the Hajj caravan that he had joined, that he would be a part of, that it was steadily moving towards Mecca, with time it would grow and grow and grow. This is something that as people would move towards it, you would naturally want to gravitate towards a caravan like this, and this would be all for safety, for your own kind of security. And the one that he was a part of was likely composed of several thousand people. That is really extensive, especially considering back in the day. And every person that participates in a caravan like this, they're responsible for themselves. They need to make sure that if they are going to be riding an animal, that is their own, that they have secured that. They need to have their own supplies. They need to have money to pay for all the varying different expenses that are going to come up. But because Ibn Battuta was still young and poor and an unemployed pilgrim, he couldn't really do much. And so he took whatever support, whatever charity, anything that he could get, and he would take it. Per his words, he managed to make friends with a law professor who would, quote, hire camels for me and gave me traveling provisions and money in addition, saying to me that it will come in useful for anything of importance that you may need or you may need of, may God reward. And from there, he was actually able to begin his Hajj.
I want to go on a journey with a camel. Maybe like a short
camels
one.
Camels are mean, though.
A light 10 miles. Can a camel? Yeah, I'm sure they can do a light 10 miles.
Yeah, they can. Heavy. They definitely can. Camels are creatures of endurance rather than speed. They can go on and walk much greater distances than horses can.
Are elephants the ones where they get back problems from being ridden?
They do, yes. Elephant spines were not designed in order to be able to accommodate saddles and things like that. So they
also, this has been a PSA to anyone who I see on an elephant. Don't do that.
Yeah.
I mean, they're nice. Don't do that.
Like, it's one of those things where you would see these constructions of like war platforms that would go on their back. And those, the only reason the elephants are able to actually sustain those during times of war is because they were designed in such a way to redistribute the weight as much as possible. There were these scenarios of, and I'm this is going to sound bad when I say this, American tourists and others that would go to places like in Thailand and others where you can go and ride elephants. And the tourists of these were much larger, we should say, than the average person. The reality of it is that when you put a person that weighs 2.5 to 3 times as much as the average person on the back of an elephant, this is something that can actually like hurt them.
Also, when you see like 3 people on one.
Yes,
like,
that is not something that you should be doing. No, absolutely not. But at least in this scenario with the camels, Ibn Battuta was able to actually begin his Hajj. So it was something that was helpful for him. And when this would happen, there wasn't going to be any kind of serious incidents. Nothing would happen. The caravan would end up arriving at Medina, which is the city of the Apostle of God from this. This would be the place where like Muhammad and a small group of followers had retreated from Mecca when it had been hostile to him. And his flight to Medina, which is the Hijra, this would mark the beginning of the Muslim calendar. When the prophet had died back in 632, his grave in Medina became the site of pilgrimage that is the second holiest site in Islam. It is second only to the Kaaba itself in Mecca. So it's extremely important, which is why they talk about in Islam the twin cities of Mecca and Medina. So then traveling for several more days and visiting more holy sites, they finally came close to Mecca. And when he arrives there, he performs the rituals that are necessary for every Muslim to do, dressed in the simple white Urim cloth that he had worn since he left Medina. And first he went to the Kaaba, the holy shrine that is shaped like a giant cube. And there he would describe the standing at Arafat, which is an essential part of the Hajj. What would happen during this event is that on the ninth day of the month of the Hajj, pilgrims would go to the plain called the Arafat, which was 12 miles east of Mecca. And there they would stand before the Mount of Mercy, where Adam in Islam had prayed and where Muhammad gave his farewell sermon in 632. And there they would recite prayers, listen to sermons until sunset. And then on the 10th morning, there is supposed to be a feast, and the pilgrims will pick up a handful of pebbles and cast seven of them at the western pillar of Mina, just as Abraham threw stones at the devil to suggest that Abraham didn't need to sacrifice his son as God had commanded. Because there's variance to the story depending upon whether you're looking at it from Judaism, Christianity, or Islam. And that is the story as it goes within Islam. Ibn Battuta would stay in Mecca for 3 weeks, and there he would make visits to other sites, he would meet with holy men, and he would study with them. It's at this point that Ibn Battuta had actually graduated from his initial goal. He had achieved the status of Al-Hajj, as in one who had been on the Hajj, which was a very important status for a Muslim scholar. It's really an important status for any Muslim, but especially important to a Qadi. That was a huge mark of, what's the right word? Piety? I think that would be the right word that I would use here. Like, it was something that was hugely important to status and conviction. The thing is, do you have any idea how long it took for him to reach this point, Gabby?
A few years.
Actually close. It took him a year and a half to reach his destination.
See, I was going to say a couple, but I was like, ooh, I need to leave it more vague.
No, see, literally, it takes a long time to be able to do any of this. And he started from Morocco, meaning he had walked all the way across North Africa, going all the way down from Egypt, down into Arabia, just to get to this point. And he would actually go and make 3 other trips to Mecca in his lifetime. But that wasn't going to happen yet. Rather than return home, he thought about all the things that he had done, all the things that he wanted to do. And instead of simply getting a permanent job, no, he could instead travel. He could continue to find work as a scholar or a judge, something that everyone in the Islamic world needed at random points and was always welcome whenever they would show up. Homesickness was gone, but Tuta had decided that he was going to see the world. So it was then that on November 17th, 1326, Ibn Battuta would leave Mecca and from there join a caravan of pilgrims in an official caravan of the Persian state. There he was treated to a half of a double camel litter by a rich official who was quite impressed with Ibn Battuta's learning and also friendly personality. This was something that was going to become very common for him throughout his travels, is that he always seemed to know how to ingratiate himself into the upper echelons of society and make friends with people, something that would be very important to guaranteeing him safe passage and also for supplying him with any kind of goods, food, and anything else that he needed. They marched at night by torchlight so that, quote, "you saw the countryside gleaming with light and darkness turn into radiant day." There was that many people with torches.
Wow.
The wife of the caliph had paid for the construction of a chain of different watering tanks and wells along the trail in order to keep the caravan safe, and the entire journey from Mecca to Mesopotamia took approximately 44 days, which is a long time, but that was short in comparison to what the initial Hajj had taken. In Al-Najaf, Ibn Battuta would visit a holy site that was important to all Muslims, but especially important to the Shia communities that lived there. Because in Al-Najaf was the mausoleum of Ali, who was the fourth caliph and the successor to Muhammad. This was Muhammad's nephew and son-in-law, and it was here that Ibn Battuta would meet Sufi Muslims for the first time, people who would try to find God through experiences, things like twirling around in a trance, using music, poetry, all kinds of stuff in order to communicate with God.
When you say twirling around, like spinning until you're dizzy?
Have you heard of the term whirling dervish?
No.
Okay, so this is an old term, and in many cases it has a kind of a racial connotation to it here. It was something that was used as a insult even back in the day. But the initial terminology for what it would be referring to for like Sufi whirling dervishes is specifically they would dance with lots of spinning. Imagine it like what our daughter does, what Joya does, where she just continuously spins and spins and spins and spins and spins. And she does it until she gets super dizzy and falls over laughing. This is pretty much what they did, along with many, many, many other things, because the senses that they tried to impart upon their body was to give them an almost out-of-body experience without actually having, you know, substance abuse or anything like that.
Okay.
So spinning, doing these actions, imagine it like a much more lively variant of some of those churches that you would see in the United States where they would be taken over by the Holy Ghost, if you've seen anything like that, like the
yes,
videos of it.
Okay. Where I'm from, we have something called a shouter Baptist. Not sure if we have that in the U.S. I just know that's what they're called back home. And they would do these TV shows where they would do that. It was always interesting to watch the live streams of the sermons.
Oh, I bet. And the thing about this, and I have to specify this, because when I mention Sufi Muslims, it would be a disservice for me not to mention that this is one of the variants of Islam that has been continuously discriminated against in many parts of history. Like when hardline Islamic extremist factions would come into power, Sufi Islamists in general are seen as heretics by many of these and have a tendency to be eradicated.
Why?
Because they're seen as something that is it's seen as a kind of heresy for some hardline Muslims.
Okay, so they're seen as not being
real Muslims.
What?
Yeah.
Is it like how sometimes in Christianity people look at other Christians and they're like, you're not a real Christian?
Sort of, yes. And you know how there was that whole thing with the Jesuits and what they would do to convert natives for like ingratiating some of the natives' beliefs into Christianity and in order to try and make the transition easier?
Yes.
Sufi Muslims would oftentimes be in areas that were more multicultural, and they tended to do the same kind of thing of taking upon some local customs and other thing and integrating it into their practices. That was something that made them be viewed by more dogmatic Islam sects as being heresy. So they had a tendency to be strongly discriminated against. But when he witnessed this, this was something that he was fascinated by it more than anything else. So once he left this region, after leaving Tlemcen, the small caravan would travel the green-brown valleys for several days at a time without encountering any towns. The only people that they ever managed to encounter during this time were Berber camps and groups of camel herds. This is where they would then arrive at Basra, something that was a city that was famous in Islamic history. But Ibn Battuta was very disappointed by this.
Some of us love history. Others used to or never did because history was presented as nothing but the rote memorization of names, dates, and facts. Basically, the story got left out, and that made history kind of suck. My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a university professor with a PhD in history, and bringing history to life is my passion. That's why I created my podcast, History That Doesn't Suck. I want to teach you everything you need to know about U.S. history, but I do so through stories. Let me tell you about George Washington begging his men not to mutiny against Congress, Clara Barton saving Union soldiers amid enemy fire, enslaved Frederick Douglass risking his life for liberty, and about so many other figures as their real experiences make industrialization, social movements, and even congressional debates and tax policy come to life. Subscribe to History That Doesn't Suck today, and join me, Professor Greg Jackson, every other week for a new episode, where I'd like to tell you a story.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies?
Well, of course you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
They've done weird things. Cat and Jethro, Box of Oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the Box of Oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
This was a city that years before had been famous for being utterly beautiful. But the city had drastically shrunk in population and importance from what it once was. When he'd attended a Friday service in the mosque, he was surprised that there were large amounts of errors in grammar that was being committed by the leader. He learned that in this town, there was not a man left who knew anything about the science of grammar. It had transformed from a city of beauty and wonder and education and learning to a complete backwater. And you may wonder, why did that happen?
Why did that happen?
The Mongols killed everybody.
That checks out, actually. Yeah, that'll do it.
Yeah, we're going to talk about this a little bit, I'm sure, when we go into some of the Mongol conquests when talking about those in history. But do you remember that when I talked about the Timur Lane and other different Mongol conquerors who came in and built literal pyramids of skulls?
Sometimes when you say something so brutal, I just block it from my memory.
Yeah, so the Mongols had come in here earlier, and this is before Timur Lane. Timur Lane hasn't even happened yet, and the regions in this have been largely depopulated. I think I saw something in here looking at it before, and I cannot remember if I put this in here, but the region around there was estimated 100 years earlier to have a population of about 2.5 million, and that was reduced to around 700,000. I think it was the number, or it was a ridiculously small number, like reduced by over 75% by the time that Ibn Battuta arrives, because that many people had been killed. It was, or not even by the time that he arrived, but afterwards with Timur Lane, it was horribly brutal. And so he continued on from his journey after being disappointed by the city that still had managed to survive, even if it had shrunk, by taking a small sailboat up the river to the city of Abadan. And along the river, he saw an uninterrupted succession of fruit gardens and overshadowing palm groves both to the right and left, with traders sitting in the shade of the trees, selling bread, fish, dates, milk, and fruit, and it was a luscious and beautiful place. Further on, in a marshy area far from civilization, he looked up a famous hermit who seemed so peaceful and happy with his life that for a while, Battuta even thought that his journey was going to end right here, that this was an Islamic scholar that had found it all, that was completely satisfied with life and was a wonderful, knowledgeable person. And he thought this is where he could potentially spend the rest of his life in service to that holy man. But no, next day, he was back on the road heading to Isfahan, the Orchard City. Now, Isfahan, which is in modern-day Iran, this was another city that had been destroyed by the first Mongol invasion. But the future destruction by the later Mongol leader, Timur the Lame, or Tamerlane, oh God, that was going to be so much worse. Tamerlane was the guy who would dominate all of Persia from 1387. And I'm pretty sure we did a patron-exclusive podcast episode on specifically that guy. His invasion of one city, of Isfahan alone, that led to more than 70,000 deaths. And this is where the records would say that he stacked heads like pyramids. Which is quite brutal. Ibn Battuta would lodge for 2 weeks there at a large Sufi center, and there he would see the sights, meet with religious legal scholars, and in general just enjoy himself before moving on. Afterwards, he would go and visit Shiraz after traveling another 300 miles to the south, and Shiraz, luckily, had not been destroyed by the Mongols. The thing was, it was way too far south, and it was way too hot. It wasn't a climate that was suitable to be able to be reached by the Mongol hordes. So the city actually ended up surviving, and this would end up growing in massive size due to the sheer amount of refugees that were fleeing from the north. The arrival of well-educated fugitives would stimulate this huge cultural growth in literature and art and everything, which would amaze Batuta, who would say that, quote, its inhabitants are handsome in figure and clean in their dress. In the whole East, there is no city except Shiraz, which approaches Damascus in its beauty of its bazaars, its fruit gardens, and its rivers. It was astounding. And it was here that I found a very funny story over the course of researching this, that Ibn Battuta heard of the miracle of a sheikh there, a local leader. And the whole reason that I put in this in the first place, Gabby, is because I knew you would appreciate it. It is the story of a guy who got saved by an elephant.
How? What occurred?
So I copied an abridged version of it into here because there's no way I'm going to be able to relate the entire thing. But as the story goes, it is related on one occasion that the sheikh of this region set out for a mountain, accompanied by 30 poor brethren. They became hungry on the way to the mountain and lost their bearings. They asked the sheikh to allow them to catch one of the small elephants, which are exceedingly numerous in that place, and are transported to the capital of the king of India. The sheikh forbade them, but their hunger got the better of them. So they disobeyed his instruction, and seizing a small elephant, they slaughtered it and ate its flesh. The sheikh, however, refused to eat it. That night, as they slept, the elephants gathered from every direction and came upon them. They went about smelling each man and killing him until they made an end of all of them. The elephants then smelled the sheikh too, but offered no violence to him. One of them took hold of him, wrapped its trunk around him, set him on his back, and brought him to the place where there was some habitation. Then the elephant, as it came near the people of the village, seized him with its trunk and gently lifted him off his back to the ground in full view of them. The people then came up and touched his robe for a blessing and took him to their king, where he received a reward for 3 rubies. So as the story goes, what ended up happening is they go out there into the middle of nowhere, they get lost, the men become hungry and they kill an elephant to eat it. This is apparently in a number of Muslim societies very bad luck. Like, you do not want to eat the flesh of an elephant. Well, technically, you can. There are a number of people who believe that the eating of elephant flesh is prohibited in the Quran. It varies depending upon the time and place, but for others, we'll say that it's extremely bad luck. And this is why they did not do it. So it's a funny little story about a guy who actually ends up surviving by not eating something while everyone else around him get killed. Either way, from here, Ibn Battuta would continue on with other traveling companions and eventually arrive at Baghdad, which was, at one time, the capital of the entire Abbasid Empire. The thing is, and this is, I know that we talked about it before when we talked about the Mongol invasions, but Baghdad had been destroyed. There he went to honor its past and walk amongst the ruins, and there he would imagine the ghosts of those who had lived in this once magnificent capital city, which at a time had had a population of around 1 million people. But that was no longer the case. As he would describe it, quote, her outward lineaments had departed, and nothing remains of her but the name. There is no beauty in her that arrests the eye, or summons the busy passerby to forget his business and to gaze. Which, I mean, to be fair, literally wasn't as bad as that. The Mongols had managed to leave many of the public buildings standing, and quite a number of people still alive. They did kill a lot of people, but they did actually end up preserving quite a bit of it. In fact, the army that had conquered Baghdad had just finished sacking the place and then immediately afterwards started a restoration program in order to rebuild it. But it didn't matter. The destruction that had been wrought by the Mongol Empire in the first place meant that Baghdad was no longer going to be the most important cultural center in the region. And even though most colleges were in ruins, one college, though, had been built in 1227, 100 years before Ibn Battuta had arrived. And weirdly enough, fun fact, that is still operating to this day. It has been restored and it's still open despite the decades of war and conflict going on in Iraq. So what I'm talking about here is the, it's just a fun fact for anyone who is curious about this, the I'm going to butcher the pronunciation of it. Al-Mustansiriya University. It was founded in Baghdad by Caliph Al-Mustansir in 1227, and it is one of the oldest universities in the world, having survived the 1258 Mongol invasion, and also when it was bombed back in 2007 by Sunni extremists. So that's a fascinating little story right there. Anyway, in Baghdad, he learned that Abu Sa'id, who was the Khan himself, like the Mongol Muslim ruler, he was staying there. And soon he was going to be leaving to his summer palaces in the Sultania. Ibn Battuta would jump at the chance to try and meet another ruler, and he got himself invited onto the royal caravan. The Il Khan was about a year younger than him, and he would describe the king as being the most beautiful of God's creatures. Which I have to say, from the beginning, is a very interesting way to describe someone. But remember how I said that this guy would constantly ingratiate himself into the upper echelons of different societies?
Yeah.
This was pretty much a tactic that would be used by any chronicler or writer or anything, is that if you were going to be serving, or rather relying on the patronage of a wealthy client, you wanted to make sure that you are, you know, on their good side. He may have actually been the most beautiful creature, as what Battuta would describe, but we don't really know. We would know that he would admire him as a true Muslim who would write both Arabic and Persian. He could play the lute. He could compose songs and poems, and apparently was a very wise ruler. The Il Khan was an example of how the Mongol warriors, their descendants would eventually transition to becoming not Mongols, but becoming basically Persian and becoming Muslim. If the stories are to be believed, he was a fantastic ruler, but this was also not going to last. The entire region at this point in history is very unstable, and the political foundations that he had made over the past 8 years where he had ruled wasn't strong enough to survive when he actually died. So when he did die, his regime in the entire region would collapse into warfare in 1335, and from there, it was not going to be pretty. Ibn Battuta would later be told of the murder of Abu Sa'id by one of his wives, who, apparently, Gabby, remember when we talked about the whole thing with you making a video about me and the Ottoman Sultan and a harem and everything like that?
Yes, yes.
Listen, one of his wives poisoned him, okay?
One of his wives.
One of his wives, yes, because he had multiple.
Maybe they all plotted it together. Maybe they were sick of him.
Well, no, but apparently this one did it, according to the story, because she was jealous of him loving another one of the wives.
Honestly, I could see that happening.
But you see is exactly why that was something that was never really all that stable. There was always competition and jealousy.
Yeah, but it's like a reality TV show, but IRL, you know, you get to live the drama.
Yes, 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 live, or in this case, literally be poisoned.
Oh, I wouldn't be poisoned. Well, I might be if one of the other wives hates me, I guess.
No, very well could happen. That was a thing that happened. And they would also try to poison your children. Not fun. Not fun.
Sounds very stable, honestly.
Anyway, after.
But anyway, that's why I'd let you have five wives.
I don't appreciate that thought. But after he would die, the emirs, which are the military leaders of society, they would end up fighting amongst each other for leadership. But that has not happened yet at this point of the story. For now, it's just fun travels. So Ibn Battuta would continue with the royal caravan for 10 days. And from there, he would decide to join a part of the caravan that was going to go north to Tabriz, which was one of the most important cities in Persia and was now part of modern-day Azerbaijan, the first capital of the Ilkhans. With the advance of the Mongol army, the inhabitants of Tabriz had been smart enough to actually open their gates and welcome them into their city without a fight, meaning they didn't all get slaughtered. So Tabriz effectively became the capital of the conquering army, and this city became an extremely important place along the Silk Road with colonies of people from all over the world, from Venice, from Genoa, from other European countries, as well as Armenians, Arabs, and even Chinese traders. It was a multicultural city that was the staging point in between East and West. There was also actually a number of Christian churches there. This city was one of the greatest centers of learning and culture in the world after the Mongol invasion. And Ibn Battuta spent almost no time exploring Tabriz, though, because he had to get back to Baghdad and join another Hajj caravan. On his way back, he would tour other places, some of them being described by Marco Polo, which is the guy we talked about before, the Italian traveler who had gone to this area 55 years earlier on his way to China. And once he was back in Baghdad, the governor would show him charity by giving him a camel litter. He was then expecting an easy trip returning home. But you know what happened?
It was not an easy trip returning home.
No, in fact, you could say that the trip was pretty shitty.
Throughout history, royals across the world were notorious for incest. They married their own relatives in order to consolidate power and keep their blood blue. But they were oblivious to the havoc all this inbreeding was having on the health of their offspring. From Egyptian pharaohs marrying their own sisters to the Habsburgs' notoriously oversized lower jaws. I explore the most shocking incestuous relationships and tragically inbred individuals in royal history. And that's just episode one. On the History Tea Time podcast, I profile remarkable queens and LGBTQ plus royals, explore royal family trees, and delve into women's medical history and other fascinating topics. I'm Lindsay Holiday, and I'm spilling the tea on history. Join me every Tuesday for new episodes of the History Tea Time podcast, wherever fine podcasts are enjoyed.
What happened? Dysentery?
Literally dysentery. Yeah, I love how you knew where I was going with the pun for that. He literally got sick with like dysentery and was just shitting himself the entire way back. So reportedly, he had to get down from his litter many times a day in order to relieve himself. And by the time he got to Mecca, he was incredibly weak because he was constantly shitting himself. By this point, naturally, when one is suffering from dysentery, Ibn Battuta needed a rest. Over the course of a year, he had managed to travel some 4,000 miles. He had crossed many different mountains, deserts. He had visited some of the greatest cities of Iraq and Western Persia. He had met with scholars, with saints, judges. He even met a literal Mongol king. And after around 1 year in Mecca, where he would live a life of prayer and learning and brotherhood and friendship, well, he got bored and he needed to travel again.
Me.
Yep, literally, that's what ends up happening with us. Every time we come back, they call, man, I'm so tired. I don't want to travel anymore. Is here for more than 2 months.
Not even 2 months. I don't think we made it to 2 months. It's usually like a month and we're like, ooh, this is kind of boring.
True, but that honestly, half of that is not our own fault because we'll usually end up having some kind of event or something else that we have to do for work and actually travel.
Yeah, true.
It's only the last two trips that we've been able to take here ourselves to do just because we wanted them. Versus because we had to go to an event. Either way, he was going to travel again. And this time, he was going to go to Africa. So after Ibn Battuta had lived and studied in Mecca for a year, he started his next adventure. From Mecca, he would go on to Jeddah on the Red Sea coast, where he and other pilgrims would be crammed onto this tiny little ship. The region here in... that's not the right word that I should use here, but it's like... the Eastern Islamic region going into the Indian Ocean, the type of ship that they used here was called a dhow. And this was a very good ship, a design which was used for like over 1,000 years. And this was Ibn Battuta's first time traveling at sea. He had never done this before. So as you can probably guess, he wasn't really looking forward to it. The Red Sea is not normally easy to navigate. It has a lot of coral reefs. It's got a lot of rocks under the waterline. Storms were very common here, as were pirates who were going to wait for the ships with travelers so they could rob and kill them. And ships, especially something that was a smaller dhow, though it was great in places like the Mediterranean, they were and good at riding the winds for the monsoons. They were quite weak in a storm, which made the trip very hostile. And a very real possibility that everything could have just collapsed and they may not have ever met or gone to their destination, which in this case almost happened, at least per Battuta. As he would say, quote, "We traveled on the sea with a favoring wind for 2 days, but thereafter the wind changed and drove us off course. The waves of the sea entered in amongst us in the vessel and the passengers fell grievously sick." In other words, this very shallow vessel that they were in was getting just constantly bombarded by waves that was going over top into the boat itself. And from that, he and others got really sick, like really seasick. Eventually, the ship would have to head for shore. And fortunately, Ibn Battuta and the other seasick passengers were able to then rent camels and continue south on land. Because quite literally, they gave up. They could not do it anymore. They could not go by boat, even though it technically speaking should have been faster.
This is like realistic travel adventures.
Literally,
the novel.
Very real risks. Yeah. And when he would go there, he still would go to all the coastal cities. He would go and visit there. He would go to the villages and the high mountains of Yemen. And in Taiz, which was high on a mountain slope, he would end up staying with the Sultan, who would give him a horse. And after a brief stay in Taiz, he would continue down to the coastal city of Aden, which is the city that guards the entrance to the Red Sea. And there was a place that was extremely rich, especially thanks to his geography.
What do you mean?
Well, you see, Aden was a city that was built in the crater of an extinct volcano, with the eastern side being exposed to the sea. And the harbor was surrounded by stone walls and sea gates for protection. Because of where it was situated, Aden was able to charge a tariff on, or like, you know, a tax on basically any kind of good that came through this port. So ships were constantly bringing spices, medicinal herbs, dyes, cloth, iron, steel, silk, cotton, pearls, literally anything you can imagine of value, they were bringing it here. All of this stuff. And because they were from where they were situated, they were able to tax everything that was going through it, making it a very fabulously wealthy place to be. In the time that Ibn Battuta lived, Muslim traders had pretty much total control over the western half of the Indian Ocean trading centers. The entire thing was pretty much like a massive Muslim lake around which all these merchants had started businesses, and they could depend upon trade by ship. These communities would develop all over the varying coastal places across India, Africa, etc. And here they would develop places that would be safe harbors to propagate Islam and also make a ton of money. In these places, if you were a person with any kind of real brain, any kind of real education, any kind of thought, you could go here and you could probably live a pretty good life, at least if you were Muslim. Like, the thing is, it didn't really matter at this point for what your racial background was, because these were strong multicultural centers. The one thing that pretty much united all of them was Islam. And this is the network that Ibn Battuta was able to travel. Because the world was not completely Muslim, here it was more of a minority religion that was specifically among traders. He would have a little bit more of a difficult time, but because there were always these isolated spots of Muslims and wherever he went, he would be able to go and actually have some kind of safety net. Now, still, each site, there was going to be someone there, a fellow Muslim, a pilgrim, a scholar, someone he was able to work with. This was part of the International Brotherhood of Islam, and he was going to take advantage of all the charity that could be offered here. From Aden, Ibn Battuta would then decide to have another adventure before settling down to try and have a permanent job, down the coast of East Africa this time. The weather conditions were just right for the trip, and it was very easy to get a dhow sailing south. The trading ships made their way down the east coast of Africa, stopping at towns to trade for goods such as ivory, gold, skin oil, animal skins, slaves, ambergris, perfumes, all the really valuable trade goods. His first stop was a place called Zila, which was a port of the Christian kingdom of Ethiopia, and there it had a large Muslim trading community. The way that he would describe this place, though, was not very kind, as he would say that it was the, quote, dirtiest, most disagreeable, and most stinking town in the world.
Oh, tell us how you really feel.
Yeah, the whole reason, it wasn't because of necessarily the people who lived there, but rather because of what they did. It was a massive harvesting station for fish. Like, there was fisheries were huge there. So they would catch the fish and they would butcher them there. And also they would butcher camels. So the blood of the camels would fill the alleyways, he would say. This meant that the entire place reeked of a fish market and slaughterhouse. So to avoid that smell, he would spend the nights on the ship, even though the water at the time was rough, but he could not deal with the stink of it. He then continued southward, and 15 days later, he would reach Mogadishu, which was the busiest and richest of the East African ports. The Indian Ocean ports had long been active trading centers for the Persian, Arabic, Indian, and European merchants, and these merchants would bring their language, their culture, and their religion to the region. As an example, Ibn Battuta even found that the Sultan of Mogadishu both spoke his native Somali, but also Arabic, which made it a great thing for him to be able to communicate with, and that his chief legal advisor was actually an Egyptian.
Multicultural!
Literally, that's all of these. Every place that you see along here, along Africa, in these region, in these Islamic trading communities, is that everything are multinational merchant communities. Everything is about foreign trade. So they are hugely not multipolar. That's not the right word. Why am I thinking of this word here? They were diverse. We're just going to say they were very diverse. And they were largely populated in the outskirts by Black Africans that would speak African languages like Somali in Mogadishu and Bantu further south. And what would happen, remember how I said that if you were a Muslim merchant with any kind of degree of brains, you could go down there and make a good fortune? These landless but somewhat wealthy Muslim men would end up going down from Arabia and other regions, and they would make their fortunes in these spots along the coast of Africa, and they would intermarry into the local tribes. So they would oftentimes have wives that were there as well as back home. In some areas, this coastal mingling of languages would eventually develop into the language we know today of Swahili. Because like Swahili was a combination between local African languages and Arabic. And that's where that comes from. Since Ibn Battuta was a genuine real scholar of Islam and law now, he was a very welcome guest for all the local officials that loved to have him. Everywhere he went, there would be feasting. He would meet with important people. This would go on for weeks before the ship would then continue southward to Zanj and then Mombasa. And from there, he would continue to the islands of Pemba and Zanzibar and finally arrive at Kilwa in what is now today part of Tanzania. This was a hugely important trading city, something that remember when we were talking about varying different African kingdoms? I specifically talked about Kilwa and Zanzibar. This is something that probably deserves its own episode in the future here. This was a ridiculously rich city, famous for its gold, and its citizens had a very high standard of living. The ruling class lived in stone houses that were up to 3 stories high, which was very rare, especially in these parts of Africa here. And these places even were equipped with indoor plumbing. Most of the population also lived in mud-walled houses with thatched roofs, but it was significantly better than most huts that other people were living in. Ibn Battuta there probably would go and pray at the Great Mosque Kilwa, which was one of the major important Islamic sites of the region, but that thing is now in ruins. Because Ibn Battuta would go and describe this and in intricate detail, it is an extremely valuable resource. Because the unfortunate reality is that, again, the entire thing is in ruins, meaning his is one of the only key sources that we have to study. And so historians have to look at specifically his descriptions to know what things actually looked like, which is sad, but also on the same end, cool. Because if this guy had decided to just not travel, we probably wouldn't have descriptions of all these things that were major important sites.
Like the stinky city.
Like the stinky city, exactly. So Ibn Battuta would stay in Kilwa for about 2 weeks, and with the changes in the monsoon winds, which that's the thing, the traders follow the season of the winds for what would happen for their for when they shift south and north. This is how they know where it is that they're supposed to go. This meant that with them shifting north, it was time for him to go back. And so a month later, he was back in southern Arabia, and from here, he would decide on another short adventure, this time to take a small ship to the Gulf of Oman. But because he did not like the crew of the ship, he and a friend decided that they would just go to Kalhat on foot.
I thought you were going to say they decided to just sail their own ship.
Nope. They decided to go on foot. They got a guide that they hired to help them. And this almost cost them their lives because that guide tried to kill them.
Of course.
The guide tried to kill them and rob them and take their clothes and valuables. But fortunately, Ibn Battuta had a spear and he was able to get it and then control the robber until they were able to break free. And finally, after becoming extremely sick and thirsty and walking with swollen and bloody feet, they would arrive at Kalhat and he would stay with the governor for 6 days and recover. After this point, he was thinking about a return trip to Mecca, which would be his third visit. And traveling mostly by land now, he would reach Mecca in the winter of 1330. After all of the exhausting sea voyages, climbing mountains in Yemen and traveling across the equator through the hottest places on earth and almost losing his life, he was tired. He was looking forward to a long rest. And for a time, that is what he would have.
Oh, he stopped traveling?
For a time.
I get it. Dysentery, almost getting killed by your guide. It's a lot. The stinky city.
Yeah. Thing is, it's not over. There is still more journey. Like this, at this point, it's probably like what? He's a third of the way, halfway through the journeying of what it was that he'd be doing. And that is precisely why I think that we are going to leave things here for that today. At this point, we've been talking for almost an hour. And if I tried to cover the rest of this tale, it would end up going for another you know, hour and a half, probably. So there's no way that we can really get into that. But this means that we're going to be doing a part one and a part two. It's been a while since we actually did a multi-part series on the podcast.
That wasn't the Patreon exclusive. That was like eight parts of the French Revolution.
That thing was supposed to be literally three podcasts long, and it ended up being eight. I'm so sorry about that for any of my patrons who are listening to this right now. But here is my promise to you. This is not going to be like the Crusades episodes, which was also like eight episodes. And it's not going to be like the French Revolution, which was eight episodes, I think, if I recall correctly. No, this is going to be a simple part one and part two. We have actually skipped quite a lot of the little stories that have happened, but there's no way that I could have included all of that and actually moved forward in a timely manner. If you want to know those stories, if you want to read all this for yourself, you should check out his book. You should check out The Rilla, because a good percentage of this information, when I'm not talking about context, specifically comes directly from The Rilla, which I was able to get a free PDF of. So my friends, thank you very much for listening. I appreciate all of you, and I hope you have a good rest of your day. Make sure to join us for our next episode that we're going to be covering into this, and also let us know what kind of episodes you'd like to see here in the future with, you know, whatever subjects or things that come to mind. Also, don't forget to check out the links down in the description. If you want ad-free episodes, you can check out our Patreon, which is down there. And don't forget to please sign up for our trips that we're going to be doing to Peru and Germany, because right now there are only a couple spots left for the early bird special.
And if those are out of your price range, come to The Reckoning. It's in Kentucky. It's a local LARPing event. It's kind of like a fantasy type world, and we're going to be part of the Hadrian Empire, and we would love to have more friends.
Some people absolutely hate this podcast. And if you hate me and you want to hit me with a foam sword,
go join the other side, and then you could hit him with the foam sword.
Literally do that. Thank you very much, my friends, and I will see you next time.
Bye.